everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdell, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's December 2019, and you're listening to episode 154, which is a conversation about the final film in the Star Wars saga, The Rise of Skywalker. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Philip Tallon, who is an assistant professor of theology at Houston Baptist University, where he chairs the apologetics department and also teaches in the Honors College. Phil has written an online exclusive film review for the Christian Research Journal, and it's called The Dead Won't Stop Talking, A Review of the Rise of Skywalker. And you can read it for free online at our website, equip.org. Phil, it's good to have you on.
Oh, very glad to be back.
Well, The Rise of Skywalker is this last film in the Skywalker saga, which all started way back when, more than 40 years ago, in 1977, with A New Hope, and includes all the infamous prequels, especially the first three films, which are extremely divisive among fans. And this is how long Star Wars has been around. It was very interesting when the prequels came back into the theaters in the 90s, I think, we went with some friends from church, and there was somebody who was, I think, in his 20s at the time, and various different ages of people, and we all went together. We were kind of like sci-fi nerd type of people at our church. And so then we went to dinner around, and we all talked about when we first saw Star Wars. So one guy's like, oh, I first saw Star Wars in, you know, elementary school. Another guy said, oh, I first saw Star Wars in junior high school. And I said, I first saw Star Wars in elementary school. And then one of the guys said, I first saw Star Wars in utero when my mom saw Star Wars, because I was born in 1977. So it's been around for a really long time, and it's built up this incredible, you know, not just corporate machine now owned by Disney, but formerly George Lucas, just with all the toys and comic books and different series on, you know, Cartoon Network and the feature films and so forth, but just also this very dedicated fan base. So this fan base has, you know, taken it, some of them, with almost religious fervor. So all of that, you know, expectation to this final film. So what do you make of this long expected end to the saga? And I do want to tell our listeners that this is going to be a spoiler filled conversation. So if you haven't seen The Rise of Skywalker and it's on your list this holiday season, please know if you're going to listen to this, that we're going to talk about plot points in the film. So you might want to come back to this later, but sometimes people don't mind spoilers. So what do you make of this end to this whole entire, basically, space opera?
Yeah, this is the long forecast ninth movie. You know, years back, you know, Lucas had talked about, you know, even before the prequels, you know, that there would be nine stories, you know, total. So you'd have, as it were, three trilogies. So I don't know what you call the, you know, nine-part trilogy, a nonagy or something like that. But it's, you know, very long expected. People have, you know, there's a lot writing on it. The first film in this new trilogy really, you know, reinvigorated audiences. People were very, you know, kind of excited. Abrams' movie was very nostalgic in a lot of ways. And, you know, I think people recognize, hey, this is sort of like A New Hope. You know, a lot of the, you know, plot structure and mechanics are the same. Characters are kind of a remix of previous characters. But they were just thrilled, I don't know, to have such a lively story. And there was a lot of kind of promise and excitement, some of which, you know, kind of was signaled in J.J. Abrams' typical mystery box style, you know, raised parentage and, you know, all these other kind of questions. What will happen with Kylo Ren? Will he be redeemed? And so, you know, here we have the conclusion to that. And I, you know, I enjoyed the movie. I went and saw it twice in the theater. You know, it's a very watchable movie. I can't imagine how incredibly difficult it must be to create a Star Wars film at all. You're working with, you know, so much audience expectation, not to mention you're working within very specific cinematic restrictions. You know, you've got the music, you've got the opening crawl, you've got those wipes, you know, that are all very distinctive. You've got so many things that already are packaged into the story, and you've got to pay all those things off. Plus you have to do something that's new and innovative. And so, you know, I would die under the pressure of that. But I do have to say, sadly, that I don't think that the film is, you know, a great conclusion to the saga. I think that it almost buckles under the weight of those previous films. And so for an adult viewer, you know, I think it's a bit of a disappointing conclusion to this long journey that, you know, we've come on. For, you know, for younger viewers and for many viewers, I think in a sense for less avid Star Wars fans, you know, seems like it'll work perfectly well. I went with my family the first time I saw it, and we brought along a friend of my 8-year-old, and I asked him afterward what he thought. And he said, I think it was the greatest movie I've ever seen. And so many people seem to like it a lot. And perhaps it's just overeducated nerds like me that have seen Star Wars too many times, have thought about it too much and want it to be too much, that are disappointed. But nonetheless, here we are.
Well, I just want to tell our listeners, a couple of times you mentioned the name J.J. Abrams. And J.J. Abrams is the director of this film, The Rise of Skywalker. But he's been around for a really long time. He has also directed The Force Awakens, plus some Mission Impossible films and some Star Trek films. And then also he's really known a lot for his television work, which kind of really launched him into this feature film work. And probably some of the most famous things that he's done is he was the executive producer of Lost. He created and directed the series Alias. And then way back when, his first foray into television was this college story called Felicity. And there's an actor from Felicity back in the late 90s that makes an appearance in this movie as well. A friend of JJ's from high school.
Oh, yeah.
That JJ does. I just wait for that cameo of that guy because I don't want to give away his name because you have to try to find him. It's kind of that Where's Waldo thing. I think in the Star Trek movie, I realized that his cameo had been a voiceover. So he always puts, you know, whether he's in a party scene or does something or just walks by, his friend from high school is in every
film. Oh, yeah. I would love to be J.J. Abrams' friend because he seems to be like a really wonderful friend. He's full. I mean, people, yeah, characters or actors from Lost, from Alias, from Felicity, you know, they're all pulled back in. He seems to be, you know, he likes to seem to work with a troupe, as it were. And sometimes that's to his benefit and other times not. But yeah, J.J. Abrams, I mean, in a sense, this movie is true to form, which is J.J. Abrams has been building up a lot of excitement and disappointing audiences for years. You know, he starts things beautifully. And so, you know, Lost and Alias were, you know, there's a ton of anticipation and excitement. And I think, you know, paying all of those things off, you know, in a very satisfying way has always been a bit of a struggle for Abrams. And so I'm not completely surprised that some of the, you know, supposedly teased things when they come out here seem kind of silly or, you know, much less satisfying than we would have hoped.
I think so. And I think he even admitted that in an interview that he is more challenged by ending things than starting things. I think that's very true of at least his television work as we know it, that's been extremely popular, especially Alias and Lost, which has probably one of the most divisive finales of all time, probably in addition to The Sopranos. Mm. So what was your relationship with Star Wars growing up? I have to tell everyone that Star Wars, the first movie from 1977, A New Hope, is my favorite film of all time. I saw it as a little kid in the theater 10 times. I have just been, you know, enthralled with that whole universe all these years. So, of course, unlike that kid that you took to The Rise of Skywalkers, you know, it's been building up for me all these years thinking through what this final chapter would be like. So how about you? What was your relationship with the Star Wars saga?
Yeah, well, I was born the year that Star Wars came out. I was born a few months after the film released. And, of course, that time it was just Star Wars. And my first experience, I'm sure, it was just playing with the toys, you know, and that was my first real encounter with Star Wars and it would have been toys from Empire Strikes Back, especially those strange bounty hunters, you know, just fascinated by them. And so I had a number of those toys and would play with them, and then eventually encountered the films on video, you know, so watching them at, you know, my cousin's house. And you know, and I do recall, you know, seeing the, you know, that scene of Luke standing on Tatooine and watching the double sunset, and, you know, and feeling the, and the, hearing the stirring theme and being totally taken away into another place. And I've always loved the movies since, though, knowing what I would consider true Star Wars fans, I've never been, you know, as serious as so many people that I know. I've only read some of the novelizations and other, you know, other products. I haven't watched, you know, all of the Rebels, you know, series or Clone Wars. And so I'm, you know, just really a noob compared with, you know, many people, but I've always loved the movies. And I thought the original trilogy had a really wonderful quality of enchantment. The strange spaces, you know, were delightful. The story is kind of elemental in a certain way that's, you know, that's charming. The actors are perfect and, you know, elevate the material. And, you know, and then like many people, I had the disappointment of watching all of the prequels, which basically lacked so much of the essential ingredients of the original trilogy. One of the big ones being that George Lucas had not directed a film since Star Wars, and also was never a great director of actors. A lot of the success of the original movie had to do with the, you know, Han Solo and Carrie Fisher and Mark Hamill to some degree going rogue on a very young director and kind of taking the reins of their performances for themselves. And so it's, you know, not surprising, as it were, that some of the really important bits of what made the original trilogy so good were missing in those later sort of overstuffed and somewhat leaden trilogy. So, you know, I've gone through, I think I've had all the typical reactions to Star Wars that a person my age has: childlike wonder, disappointment, and then enjoyment at the rebirth of, you know, of Star Wars. I haven't been amazed by, you know, all the movies that have come out, but I've been seeing them all and enjoyed getting to still run around and play in this universe.
Our last review for this saga was about the previous film, which was The Last Jedi. And that review posited that The Last Jedi was a film for the nuns. And so that would be probably millennial or younger generation people who are really no religion, which is why they've been dubbed by research, you know, statistician scientists, social scientists as nuns. So who would you say this film is for?
Well, I think that's a good assessment of The Last Jedi, which is so much about breaking with the past, right? Though The Last Jedi tells a little bit of a complicated story there. You know, Yoda burns the tree with the, you know, Jedi text, the Book of Wills, but Rey has taken them, and we see her studying them in this film. But The Last Jedi was about, you know, subverting, disappointing, in certain ways, breaking with tradition. This is Luke's message, and this film is tonally the exact opposite. It is about the, you know, sort of, as it were, connecting with the past, you know, finding your kind of proper connection, as it were, being adopted back into the past. And so one of the running themes of the film is, as it were, the kind of the, how Rey is sort of all of the knowledge of the Jedi. So Luke says to her, you know, 1,000 generations live in you. So there's this notion that, like, kind of all of the Jedi are with her. But, surprise, and here comes a spoiler bit, it turns out that Rey, unlike what was stated in The Last Jedi, is in fact not of lowly and ignoble birth, but rather is the granddaughter of Emperor Palpatine from the original trilogy and the prequels. And so she's almost, as it were, been created as a possible vessel for Emperor Palpatine, who's still alive, to go into and inhabit so that he can continue to live on. And so for Rey, and she's existing, as it were, almost in a tug of war between these two families, the Skywalker family and the Palpatine family. And the question is, you know, which direction will she go? Obviously, Kylo Ren has experienced this tug for most of his story as well. And so the concern of J.J. Abrams is much less of a, maybe what you kind of call a, you know, Rian Johnson's, you know, kind of breaking with the past, sort of doing something new. The Force is for everyone. We don't need these kind of old traditions. Abrams is all about the old ways and the old traditions. And that, I think, in some sense, the film is made not for nuns, but for people like me, people who grew up with and are saturated with the lore and history of Star Wars, and want to have all of that kind of brought to bear. Want to sort of, as it were, relive all of our memories. And the theology, as it were, that's, you know, at play here is perhaps more strongly focused on ancestors than any other Star Wars film that I can think of. And so it's those who have died and gone before are continually present with Rey. Their voices, as it were, kind of fill the entire universe. And so there's a kind of a traditionalist bent, in a sense, that Abrams brings to bear.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Dr. Philip Tellen, and he has written an online exclusive film review for the Christian Research Journal about the last film in the 9-film Star Wars saga, and his review is called The Dead Won't Stop Talking, a review of The Rise of Skywalker. You can read his review free online at our website, equip.org. As we head towards the end of the year and are thinking about this holiday season, we'd like to invite you to partner with us with a year-end gift. I know this is a time of year where a lot of people are giving gifts to their favorite ministries, and we'd like to ask you to partner with us and help keep our content free. As you know, we have a ton of Postmodern Realities podcasts, and this is our podcast number 154, and we've been going since 2016. So for the last 3 years, we're going to enter our fourth year of this podcast, and we'd love it if you would help us to keep all of this content completely free. In addition to this podcast, we give you so many exclusive either feature articles or film reviews or book reviews or television series reviews, and please consider giving to the Christian Research Institute. Please go to our website, equip.org, and click on that donate link, and every gift counts. No gift is too small. You can tip us a small amount for all of our podcasts and articles, or a more substantial gift as you think about giving to organizations where you appreciate their content, just like this one. And so we want to thank you for your partnership and for how you partner with us, even if it's not with a financial gift, just letting other people know. Share this podcast with a friend. Just tell friends about this podcast, and that's another way in which you can partner with us. And thank you. We were just briefly starting to talk about comparing the previous film, The Last Jedi, which was directed by Rian Johnson, and this current film, which was directed by J.J. Abrams. And according to Rotten Tomatoes, which if people don't frequent that website, it's an American website that aggregates film and TV reviews. So according to that website, The Rise of Skywalker has been pretty much soundly dissed by critics, but it's been a major hit with the audiences, although it's the first Star Wars film to earn less than an overall A score from, you know, people who see the film and that are interviewed on the way out. So actually on that site, The Last Jedi is the opposite. Critics loved it, and to say that diehard Star Wars fans hated it is kind of an understatement. I mean, there was so much internet hate over The Last Jedi from fans. So why do you think this is for the two films? Why this kind of opposite flip of critics and audiences loving and hating each one?
Well, I think, you know, so as everything is now in modern life, you know, it's all shot through. Everything is problematic, and everything is an issue. And so some of the divide between, you know, as it were, Rise of Skywalker lovers and Last Jedi lovers, you know, there's the little bit of a kind of a red-blue divide, you know, sort of, okay, are you an elite, you know, or are you just sort of like a red-blooded American? And so that's, you know, been a bit of the dynamic. And or are you a kind of a critic, as it were, who's looking for someone to do something new? Or are you a normal audience member who wants to kind of, as it were, get your money's worth and get the Star Wars that you paid for? And so I think these shifts, these dynamics are playing out in how these two films are received. I think that's pretty understandable given the, you know, having watched the movie, which is that the Rise of Skywalker is fairly derivative. It does very little that's notably new or surprising. And the things that are kind of unusual about it are glossed over largely because they're strange plot holes or they seem highly unbelievable. But it's a fast-moving movie. You know, there's very little kind of discussion of big ideas or themes. It's, you know, just sort of, it's full of kind of dash and energy, even if a bit tiresomely dependent on the previous films. Whereas The Last Jedi, you know, is, as the middle movies in Star Wars sometimes are, it was a lot sort of slower. You have the strange slow, you know, speed chase. You have characters trying things and failing somewhat frequently. So we have a whole middle section where characters strike out on their own in defiance of orders and then fail in their mission. You have Rey's training not going well. You have a disillusioned Jedi Master. And to some degree, the big idea of the film is one that cuts against the heart of the fandom, which is Luke's idea that, you know, the Jedi really don't have ownership of the Force. The Force is for everyone. And so the final shot of the film, you see a young boy looking at a kind of at the night sky, reaches for his broom and kind of pulls it to him with Force powers, perhaps unknowingly. And so it is an anti-traditionalist push, and it also pushes against all of the investment we have, as it were, in the kind of the structures and the religion of the world, all the things that make Star Wars, Star Wars. And so for a critic who's looking for new, innovative things, Last Jedi is very exciting, even if a bit odd in its kind of structure and pacing, whereas The Rise of Skywalker feels very familiar. There's also an additional element, which is this has come out that Russian social media trolls have also been trying to aggravate the, as it were, this divide between Last Jedi lovers and haters by, you know, kind of stirring up more of the conflict. And so we are sort of under social media attack around this. And so I think that's probably contributed a bit to the polarization of opinions about The Last Jedi. So don't trust everybody that, you know, you see talking about it, because some of them may in fact be bots or trolls or some such thing.
So I guess trolls aren't just into politics. They're just even crossing over into sci-fi. Well, I'm sure some of our listeners are wondering, this is a podcast about faith, religion, apologetics, cultural apologetics. So it seems like we're talking a lot about the directors and the plot points and things like that. But I think one of the things that seemed really novel about the first film in 1977, you know, in addition to the distinctive style and the characters and those kinds of things, was some of the themes in it, that it did have a religious undertone, especially the Force. That was a whole new thing for people. And I think it's been well documented that George Lucas borrowed heavily from Joseph Campbell on the Force and a lot of Eastern concepts there. But for kids that were Christians, at least for myself, I felt like, oh, are they talking about God? It had some religious elements. I was just wondering about that. I remember. So what's the view of God in these movies? And how does The Rise of Skywalker affect our understanding of the, you know, quote, theology, end quote, of the series? I know that some new concepts were introduced in The Last Jedi, especially with the astral projection and some other things like that, channeling and those kinds of things, where you can now be in different places but be communicating with someone else. And so, you know, bringing some of those concepts in. So kind of unpack that for us. Like, does The Rise of Skywalker add anything new religiously into that whole idea of the Force?
Well, it adds some new elements to the Force, new Force powers. We have carried over from The Last Jedi that Rey and Kylo Ren, you know, can almost inhabit the same space despite being at a great distance. So much so that they at one point have a lightsaber battle, even though they're in two different places. It's cinematically, it's a very exciting sequence. It's never really explained how all this works. They're not force projecting. They actually seem to be in the same space. And so you have some other new powers. You see there's this kind of life drain power that the Emperor has. And as I mentioned before, there's a greater emphasis on, as it were, the ongoing personal existence of deceased Jedi or Sith that in some way seem to kind of inhabit the bodies of Jedi or Sith, or can, you know, are present in a certain way. And so toward the end of the film, the Emperor Palpatine has basically got, now, so this is again big spoilers here, has got Rey and Kylo Ren on his hidden Sith planet, and he reveals his plan that he wanted to bring his granddaughter here so that she would strike him down, but then his spirit would inhabit and control her. He would, as it were, kind of possess her. And this is something that's been a part of, as it were, Sith theology, is that, you know, those sort of the apprentice kills the master, and then, you know, they kind of live on. But it in the movies, it's somewhat new, this notion that, you know, that the sort of the master will continue to live on through new vessels. And so, you know, there, this heavy ancestor emphasis runs throughout the film, which is much like many things in the Force, seems to be a mashup of various religious ideas, you know, so perhaps some notion of like a reincarnating Buddha, or something like Avatar, The Last Airbender, where you have, as it were, kind of a single representative that carries with them the sort of the knowledge of all of these previous people. Rey seems to, in some sense, have all of the Jedi within her. And then he, you know, Palpatine wants her to be his vessel. And so it's this heavy focus on ancestors that's notable, if not entirely new. This movie just is all about ancestors. At one point, you go to another desert planet, and there's an ancestor festival, and C-3PO comments that this happens every 42 years, which is exactly the number of years that Star Wars has been out. It's also my exact age, you know, so it's all this focus on, you know, people who have gone before. You see Rey studying the Jedi tomes and kind of gaining wisdom from the past. And so I think that, you know, if as the stories continue, that might add a new element that wasn't as prominent before. There have always been Force ghosts and other people hanging around. But in this movie, just everybody who's dead pretty much comes back and makes an appearance. Leia, the surprise, dies at one point. Of course, Luke has died in the previous movie. And then even Han Solo, who is not seem to be a Force sensitive in any particular way, shows up and has a scene with Kylo Ren that he says is just from his memory. And so if there were, as a, you know, kind of a religious element that might be taken away, it'd almost be some sort of ancestral religious element from this movie in particular. But as always, the Force is, it's basically a kind of diffused magic in things, which, you know, has a kind of a light side and a dark side. But, you know, there's certainly no providential kind of ordering of the universe. There's no God. That morality is pretty clear, but it's not clear where it comes from, particularly since the Force can be used for good or evil. It's a child's, you know, kind of picture of a moral universe, which is somewhat uncomplicated and unphilosophical, but it's never been particularly sophisticated or delineated in the films, at the very least, what the Force is and does.
Well, continuing on with our spoilers here, we were talking about the director, J.J. Abrams, and he did direct The Force Awakens, and he didn't direct the eighth film, but he did direct the final film. So how do you feel that J.J. Abrams wrapped up the trilogy? Do you think he did a good job? Do you think he was sentimental in what he did? Or do you think it was really one for the fans that they would love? Or, you know, because there was that differentiation that we talked about between the critics and the fans about this particular film.
Yeah, so I think for, you know, many viewers, this seems like it'll be, you know, a very satisfying conclusion to the series. I think it's functional, you know, to use a Simpsons words, I think it's a perfectly cromulent ending. And, you know, and it's the kind of thing that, you know, I think very few filmmakers would have the ability to do even decently. It's a, you know, there's so much weight and pressure. There is, I mean, there are big questions for the fandom. And so this is a little bit unclear as to how Disney and the various producers, people like Kathleen Kennedy, how they were shaping the story all along. Because the impression that audiences get now is that this trilogy was sort of like a game of what you might call exquisite corpse or something, basically like a creative writing exercise where each director kind of gets to add their bit to the story, and then it's on the last director to wrap everything up. And, you know, Abrams and others have said that, you know, they had a plan from the very beginning of where they were going to go, but it certainly doesn't feel like that. It feels like there's a tug of war in the movie for the meaning of Star Wars. You know, whether that meaning is going to be past looking, you know, which is definitely J.J. Abrams' focus, or whether it's, you know, going to be future looking, you know, which is Rian Johnson's focus. And so, you know, I think that for those who reflect on such things, you know, there is a kind of a bit of an unsatisfying quality to all of this, because it, you know, it seems as though, you know, just yet another kind of aspect of cultural life is now suddenly fraught with, you know, kind of tension and these questions about what sort of person are you? Are you this kind of person or that kind of person? But on the other hand, these are, again, largely issues for people who probably are thinking, you know, way too much about Star Wars or caring too much about, you know, it being the film that they remembered and loved from their childhood. My kids had a, you know, fabulous experience watching the movie. They really liked it. My daughter, before we went, said, you know, I'm not really so sure about, you know, going, I don't love Star Wars. And she watched the movie and she thought it was great. And so, you know, one can hardly blame a movie which has pitched it, you know, big general audiences for not satisfying the most dedicated, thoughtful parts of the fan base when what is trying to be achieved is something which is incredibly complex.
So how has the meaning of Star Wars changed over the past 42 years in these 9 films?
Well, you know, obviously originally it was, this immersion to a strange world of fantasy. You know, at the time it was an incredibly innovative film technologically, you know, and hyper accelerated, you know, for its day, though now the original Star Wars movie seems, you know, very deliberately paced. It's much slower than the speed of current movies. And so that it combined, you know, as it were, kind of a backward looking nostalgia for the forms of these old serials and adventure stories, Flash Gordon, while being also, very just technologically advanced. And so, you know, obviously the meaning has changed to some degree just because of the amount of time we've now spent with Star Wars. We've got more and more of the mythology built up. We've had, you know, some very disappointing films. The franchise has now changed hands. And so it's a very, you know, kind of fraught sort of story in a certain way because it's continually kind of changing. Unlike, say, James Bond, who always represents the same thing, you know, which is just to be cool, killer government agent, you know, who gets to sort of behave badly but for the cause of the good. You know, Star Wars is a story that's unfolding, and these new additions can profoundly change the meaning there. Part of what excited me about Rian Johnson's The Last Jedi was the suggestion, as it were, that there are a lot of other stories out there in the wide universe that could be told, you know, sort of in the same Star Wars setting and style to some degree, but completely detached from, you know, Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker and Death Stars and so forth. And I do really long for some of that sense of disorientation and discovery that I had with the original trilogy, of being in a new place with new names. And so I've never been overly enamored with all of this gap filling and backstory filling in the series has been so much engaged in. I like The Mandalorian. I don't love that it's set in the past, you know, in between after the Return of the Jedi. I wish they would start telling stories that take place in the future and let the, you know, as it were, kind of set the stories free to go into new and unexpected places. So to get back to your question, what's the meaning now? I mean, I think the meaning that if Abrams wants to have is that, you know, is a nostalgic one, which is that, you know, isn't this kind of nice to return to these characters and to play in the same world we were in before? And that's not something that I'm as interested in as I once was.
So there might be somebody out there on the fence, maybe in China because it's bombing over there. But for some reason, if there's somebody who hasn't seen this film already, do you recommend they go see it?
Well, yeah, I would. It's very highly enjoyable. And the music is stirring. The action is mostly exciting. If you try to think too hard about the Emperor's plan, you'll probably make you sadder or, you know, find it, you know, amusingly laughable. But, you know, I think that the actors at the center of this film are charming. They're kind of wonderful discoveries, or at least, you know, relatively unknown actors before they came in. And the movie's told with a great amount of dash and movement. You certainly won't be bored. And I think given how prominent Star Wars is and will likely continue to be, it's something that's good to be aware of and talk about. And honestly, I mean, just, you know, I heard somebody speak the other day and he said he really loved movies, but he'd never seen Star Wars. And I think that, you know, you just lose so much cultural credibility if you admit something like this, that, you know, if you want to be kind of culturally engaged, it's just something you got to go check out.
Well, I do remember when my oldest who's 22 now, was in high school. He said that he met somebody in his grade who had never seen Star Wars. And he said, "Can you believe that, Mama? She has never seen Star Wars." He was just kind of amazed. How could you never see Star Wars? I guess her parents aren't Star Wars nerds like me. My kids to Star Wars at a very young age. As a matter of fact, even though I'm not a fan of the first three films, especially The Phantom Menace, I remember when it came out, my son was really small at the time, and we went to see it in the theater, and Legos were coming out and all this, so we got some Lego sets with the Gungan and everything. But I'm sure they're, if like wanted to sell them on eBay, they'd be worth a lot of money, because that was a long time ago, 20 years ago.
Oh yeah, I've lost, you know, thousands of dollars worth of old Star Wars toys over the course.
I know. If you could only go back to the 70s and save those classic toys, you could make a killing on eBay.
I suppose so. I think that, you know, with a lot of these things, they're best to, you know, hold them a bit lightly. So one of the things that does concern me, and I maybe have to check myself a bit, is, you know, is needing for Star Wars to be something that it really never should have been, you know, which is the, you know, the most central kind of important cultural, you know, artifact. And so, you know, hopefully Christians at the very least will have some sense of priorities that will, you know, kind of keep them from being overly enraged or drawn into silly arguments over this movie, and we'll just, you know, can still find ways to enjoy and appreciate it for what it is, which is, you know, at the end of the day, a very well made, but, you know, kind of childish mythological story that was probably never intended to be the biggest movie of all time.
And for those who, you know, because it has captured this kind of cultural moment right now, because it's come out and everybody's revisiting their childhood or introducing their kids to Star Wars, how can Christians use this film or this whole entire series kind of as a springboard to share the gospel?
Well, it will, of course, raise the kind of question of tradition. I mean, I think that it's, you know, the movie shows in a very big way our need to embed ourselves within larger stories in order to make meaning of our lives. And so the movie concludes, I don't think we've mentioned this yet, but the movie concludes with Rey, who is thus far, for the most of the series, has only had a single name. She discovers that she is in fact a Palpatine, so presumably her name is Rey Palpatine, but rejects Emperor Palpatine and eventually defeats him in a kind of a Harry Potterish sort of way. And then she returns to Luke's homestead on Tatooine that he lived in with his Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru. And someone asks them, you know, "What's your name?" She says her name is Rey. And she looks over and she sees the Force ghosts of Luke and Leia. She says, "Rey Skywalker." And she, as it were, adopts herself into this family. And that, I think that shows that there's this, you know, we're hungry for meaning. We're hungry for story. We want to find ourselves in big stories. People want to find themselves in the Star Wars story. But the only stories that will ultimately satisfy are ones that are good, that are beautiful, and that are true. And the Christian narrative is all three of those.
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid-fire questions for Phil. So, Phil, we just celebrated Christmas this week. Is there a traditional Christmas meal that your family eats?
There is. My father-in-law is Lebanese heritage, and so every Christmas we eat Lebanese food. It's, you know, a lot of very standard Mediterranean dishes. So we have things. I'm not 100% sure what their actual names are. I just sort of know their kind of family names that are passed down. So kibbeh and shakshuka, and, you know, we have this, you know, Syrian, you know, flatbread, and it's a, you know, basically a special meal that's a fair amount of work to prepare. And which we only have a few times a year. So that will be our Christmas Day meal.
And what were some of the gifts that you got for your kids this Christmas?
Well, we went to go see, so my kids' favorite band at the moment is a band, my younger kids, I should say, is a band called Harry and the Potters, which is the original wizard rock band. And we went to see them in concert at our local library. And I bought some t-shirts on the sly, and they will be receiving Harry and the Potters t-shirts, all four of them, and I think they'll have enjoyed those.
Well, New Year's is in about a week, so do you make any New Year's resolutions?
Yes, I mean, I typically try and, you know, find something that's doable, though I tend to forget about them more often than fall back, you know, on them. And so I'll probably try and, you know, pick something small and, you know, beneficial, you know, like to, you know, read a certain book or some such thing as that, or, you know, read more Shakespeare or some such thing.
Well, speaking of books, name a book that you read this year that you think everyone should read in 2020.
Oh, well, that's a great question. I read a lot of new books this year. I have an old book to recommend, which is that I read through Chrétien de Troyes' Arthurian romances that I thought were delightful. And so, you know, people who love fantasy and who love tales of adventure, and I think we're all kind of in that place, often will know Thomas Malory's Arthurian legends and his Lame Mort d'Arthur, but Chrétien de Troyes are a lot wilder. They're more fast-moving, they're sort of crazy and chaotic, and they're an absolute blast to read. And so if anyone out there likes Arthurian romances and stories, I would check out Chrétien de Troyes. There's a Penguin, you know, classics paperback that's available, and I think it's a fine read.
Well, that's a fascinating choice. Thanks, Phil, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. And today's guest has been Dr. Philip Tallon. He has written an online exclusive film review of the final film in the Star Wars 9-film saga. And his film is called The Dead Won't Stop Talking, A Review of the Rise of Skywalker. It's available free online at our website, equip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. And please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and please rate and review our podcast. When you rate and review our podcast, it helps others see our content. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.